For a unit size between 2 to 5, they would have to meet a NOx limit of 30 parts per million. Then on the between 5 to 20, 15, anything greater than 20 would be 9. Then strictly for oil field steam generators, anything greater than or equal to 2, they would have to meet a NOx limit of 15 ppm. As you see on the last column, CO limit, they're all the same, 400 ppm. So the reason why we put a CO limit on this roof 441 is that we wanted to ensure that we're not going to increase CO emissions by reducing NOx limits. So staff felt that a CO limit placeholder was necessary. So what are the different control technologies that are out there currently in the market that will help achieve these units to meet the NOx emission limits set forth in our rule? The most common one right now we have out there right now is the ultra low NOx burner. Ultra low NOx burners, how their technology uses, what they use is air to fuel mixing, to control air to fuel mixing, and then also manage the peak flame temperatures. So in result, by doing that, they help reduce NOx formation, so therefore reducing NOx emissions. When we're designing a control technology rule, the California Health and Safety Code require us to evaluate different control technology, or they want us to do a incremental cost-effective analysis. So staff conducted a incremental cost-effective analysis by comparing the two technologies out there, one ultra-low NOx burner, and then the other one adding a selective catalytic reduction, also known as SCR. The use of an SCR requires you to inject aqueous ammonia into the exhaust stream, which then reacts with the flue gas over a catalyst, which then reduces the NOx emissions. Installing SCRs on units can be quite expensive, with preliminary costs reaching up to $50,000 per ton of NOx reduced. So after comparing these two different technologies, staff concluded that achieving the NOx limit, the most cost-effective means was to install an ultra-low NOx burner. So after this unit, the facilities that are subject to Rule 441 for their units, there are different compliance schedules that they have to meet. The first thing is that they have to submit a written plan on how they're going to achieve meeting the emissions limits from Rule 441 by December 31, 2020. After that, they have to submit a authority to construct or permit to operate application by December 31, 2021. Then after submitting an application, they have to demonstrate full compliance by December 31, 2023. Within Rule 441, there are some exemptions that we have developed to the BARC limits. The first one will be the low fuel usage limit, and this basically says that if your units use fuel that is less than 90,000 therms per calendar year, you don't have to meet the emissions limit set forth in Rule 441. The second exemption is for any units that were non-operational, meaning they weren't operating within throughout the whole calendar year, they don't have to meet the emission limits. And there's also another exemption to the BARC limit, which is operation of units during curtailment conditions. So basically what this means is curtailment conditions. Sometimes these units are normally fired only on natural gas fuel. So when for PG&E cuts off the gas lines due to unforeseen circumstances, those units can use alternative fuels such as diesel or crude oil, but only up to 200 hours per year. For those units that were qualifying for the exemptions under the low use and non-operational exemption, they do have to meet certain standards, and as well, if their status ever changes, they have to meet the compliance schedule outlined in our rule. So what that means is for low use units that were exempt and no longer exempt, they lost that exemption because they exceeded the fuel usage. Within 30 days, notify the district that, hey, we exceeded the fuel usage, we're notifying you. And then within 90 days, submit an application to meet the requirements set forth in Rule 441. Then within 12 months after exceeding the low fuel usage year, they have to demonstrate full compliance. And then for the non-operational units, if they were to ever come back online, they have to first demonstrate that they have retrofitted their units to meet the emissions limits before they can start up the unit again. All right, what are the rule impacts? So by implementing this rule, the district anticipates that we will reduce NOx emissions by approximately 352 to 1,392 tons per year. And what will be the cost to retrofit these units? Depending on its sizes, the range can cost between $555 to 26,000 tons per ton of NOx reduced. And what was taken into account to our analysis, we looked at the capital costs, the operating costs, the maintenance costs, electricity, permit fees, and all of this is detailed outlined in my staff report in page 10. So if you guys would want a detailed review of what was how we did our cost effective analysis, you can read that section. And then what is our proposed route timeline? We're gonna have a public workshop on January 15, 2020. And then we are hoping to have a board adoption hearing on February 19, 2020. And that will conclude my presentation. And if you have any questions.
Questions from the
Bob? I think Bob had a question.
You have the source categories broken into two varieties, the boilers versus oil fields.
Yes.
Essentially. And it looks like the oil field has to reduce it twice as much.
Yeah.
Why are we separating them out? And
so normally for oil field steam generators, there's a difference between BART and BAT. This is BART is to retrofit retrofit old existing equipment, and so therefore we wanted to really tailor these this rule for the sources that were going to be only affected, and those were oil field steam generators. By comparing other district rule, we felt that by meeting 15 ppm was being aligned with other districts, and therefore we decided to go with 15 ppm for oil field steam generators. So when we are taking account, so when I talked about the different costs, we look at the installation cost. That was all the capital cost. That's all that one-time cost, right? Installation, labor, and then that's why we take account the ongoing cost, which is the operation and maintenance cost. How much it will take account over the years, and we looked at it. And there's equations that we use, and we looked at over a 10-year equipment lifespan based upon the manufacturer. They guarantee you that the low NOx burner can last over 10 years, so that's why we chose a 10-year lifespan. And the calculation, we analyzed the capital cost by plugging into all the different interests and all the capital costs, and then that's how we determined the 500.
So over 10 years, $5,000,
so it will cost them to per ton of NOx reduce it roughly about $20,000 per ton of NOx. It depends on the it ranges depending on the unit's size.
Can you go back to that slide?
Yeah. So yeah, we do have information, and that's how we did our analysis. So how I did my analysis, I broke it down to the different source category sizes. So I looked at it. I think it would be best if we look at page 10 or 11 of my staff report. If we look at table 9 and 10.
I guess I'm still not clear on what that $26,080 represents. Is that a per year cost then as over that 10-year period?
It's not looking at it per year. It's based upon how much NOx is reduced. So depending on how much.
So the $555 to $46,000 is not initial cost per unit, that's cost per ton of NOx reduced.
Yes.
So
So say...
So we're looking, if we went in the middle of that cost range, in the middle of the not tons, you're talking about $10 million, that, right?
Yeah, so if you were saying 10,000 and it reduces 1,000 tons over the course of the year, it's like going to cost them $10 million, basically. Yeah.
The questions? I have a few questions. Your criteria for cost effectiveness,
mm-hmm.
How did you determine that 50,000 was not cost effective?
That was based upon other staff reports conducted by the other districts. So that 50,000 ton was already evaluated by Santa Barbara Air Pollution Control District. They did the analysis and they determined that by contacting manufacturers and get their costs. And so we just use them as a reference.
So there's no state guidance on?
There is an EPA tool that allows you to get, that calculates the different costs for everything. You know, it's the same guidelines as they look at what's the installation cost, what's
the labor
cost.
Well, I understand that. I'm just, you know, some, what? Okay, that's what I was looking for.
Okay.
And the same question relates to the NOx limits. Any guidelines?
There was also no guidelines. So this was a direction from AB 617. We had to reduce NOx emissions. And so what we did was we compared what other air districts are doing. Some have it at 15, 30, where it's very, we were aligning to them. Some were a little bit more stringent as to meet 9 ppm. But that's basically meeting 9 is bad.
In terms of the other districts, their rules have been approved?
Yes, correct.
You implied a relationship between NOx and CO.
Yeah.
Could you describe that?
When you are retrofitting an ultra-low NOx burner, what you're doing is you're increasing the flame. And by increasing the flame, you could, you know, that's more... heat, more time that you're burning, so therefore that you could increase CO emissions by doing that. So therefore, you know, by retrofitting the control technology, we're reducing one pollutant, but we could increase the other pollutant in cost of that. You know, it's a, so in order for us not to have that, we wanted to ensure that you're not increasing CO emissions by still.
Curious about the relationship.
Yeah.
And one question, not related to the rule, but the governor recently took some action related to steam generators. So it just relates to new ones? Well, okay. It was a curiosity.
Well, could you again review why the exemptions, how they were arrived at?
Also, again, most of our rule requirements and everything, we compared it with other air districts to kind of be in line with their control technology rule, and wanted to be consistent across the different state of how other air districts are implementing this rule, and so therefore,
exempted whole category.
What do you mean by? I mean, we only exempted.
For example, on your page, agenda page number 30, you list the exemptions.
Oh, for the different processes.
Yes.
Yeah, so, well, this is only targeting boilers and process heaters and steam generators, and we wanted to clarify, you know, that kilns, ovens, open heated tanks, dehydrators, crematories are not necessary in this category, and so we just wanted to, we added this just for clarification purposes, just so that this rule is only targeting boilers, process heaters, and steam generators strictly, so... You know, people might get confused. What about a kiln, oven, open heaters? They might have the same description as a boiler, but not necessary for the purpose of this rule. It's not. We're trying to differentiate that.
And the exemption for electric utilities, is that fit in the same?
Exemption for electric
the first one.
Oh, yes, any unit that is exclusive use by an electric utility to generate electricity. I think that was set for so that's,
just so I may add, those are actually already under control. So the power plant locally did install SCR back in the early 2000s, and they reduced their NOx by 90%. So just because it's exempted for the purpose of this regulation does not mean it's exempted from regulation. It may have its own special regulation that applies directly to it. So those are just, we usually write rules by source category, so we have an appreciation for the differences between, not every combustion is the same. So steam generators are a lot different than turbines at power plants, or one could say. So we usually have specific rules to address specific processes. There's not a blanket rule saying you shall not emit NOx. I think it would be helpful too, Song, if you would just give us an indication of what these boilers or processes are currently emitting relative to NOx.
So, let me just open up my staff report. So on page 9 of my staff report, I detailed what were the different sizes that were subject to Rule 441, and you will see that majority, like 24 units, are the higher emitting units that were greater than 20 million BTUs per hour, and these usually are the 60 to 62.5 range. They're pretty large, and right now, currently, they're permitted to emit about close to 180 parts per million of NOx, so we're going from 180 parts per million down to 15, so you can see the great reduction in that emissions, which is why you see that the range between the NOx reduced is so large, from 352 tons to about 1,300 tons of NOx reduced.
You indicated that overall reductions range from 550 tons per year to 1,000?
Yes. The reason why I gave us a range was because, you know, in practical speaking, these steam generators are not running full capacity. So what I did, how I determined that range was I did an operating capacity factor, assuming, okay, how much emissions are reduced, assuming that they only operate 25%, and what is 50%, and what is 75%, and what is 100%. And so that low end of 352 is assuming, let's say, they operate at 25% loads, we're going to reduce this much. And then the higher range was from...
The reason for my question was, typically we deal in tons per day in terms of ozone planning, and that just doesn't seem like a huge reduction in daily NOx emissions when you compare it to the overall inventory, and it seems kind of expensive in relationship to other controls. But could you comment on how these reductions might help us meet the state ozone standards?
Well, obviously by reducing more emissions.
Well, I understand that, but it seems like a small percentage in comparison to the overall inventory. What's the overall NOx inventory in Monterey County, for example?
I don't know that on the top of my head.
How many?
This is some of the last one, and I'm sure the last one to go after about the first one.
I was just curious about the relationship to daily NOx emissions and how that helps us achieve the ozone thing. That's why I asked the question.
We probably have to get into some things on the
No, I understand. But you have a ballpark.
Basically, so the seat of the pants, to be honest, is we're sort of coming in and following the train. Everybody else is not really global.
Okay.
So we're, you know, someone looked around at other air districts and oil and gas operations. And so that's what they've got to do too. Admittedly, some of these have worse air quality issues than they do.
Any other questions? I understand that. I just looking at the overall picture and how this helps us meet the ozone standard. Alan?
Yeah, this is kind of a difficult thing to really fully implement. So I'm just going to keep a few things that I think I can, and that is, one is that there is no real guidance for the amount of rejection from 441 or from the state. You're basing what, and then the key word feasible, you're basing the feasible reductions based on what other districts have done. Am I correct so far?
Yes.
So your biggest challenge was to develop reductions based on your analysis of those other approaches, and what I'm probably got some feedback from industry here too of what's feasible. Is that correct?
Yeah, so part of our cost effective analysis, we did reach out to our industry sources that were affected to help us provide us cost and everything. Where we anticipate getting a full detailed analysis hopefully soon from those industry sources, and we did receive a different and more updated cost, but that still won't change the analysis that it is not cost effective. It is still going to show
so,
that it's
so
cost effective.
So what we're being presented today is what you and staff are saying is the most feasible approach to get the maximum amount of reduction?
Correct.
Is that a correct statement?
Correct.
Yes.
Okay, so I think I...
It's also the feasibility of the manufacturer of the devices. So, and we have to push it to get down to the right type of manual necessary. I think that would be a little simple, and it would be not feasible for the manufacturer to make that. So we know they're being manufactured. That always makes the feasibility a lot easier. So we're not, we're not blazing any new trails here. This has already been done. We know it can be done.
At the local district level, say in 2 years, if there's more advanced technology available to make the feasibility of reducing further, is that something you can do on your own, or does that require more state legislation to allow you to do that?
So that's why we're at this spot and why. These guys are not having had anything. We haven't had any changes. There's something called resource reviews. If they're able to change any process or device, they would have to go through that, and they would have to use that available to support technology. So there is a process in place that if you're going to change up anything, you would have to apply the latest changes to technology, so to speak. But a lot of these guys have been operating on this for a long period of time, and then they haven't changed from that. So, and 617 came through and said, you have to look at these particular facilities and see what can be done to reduce emissions.
Well, that was the purpose of my question, because if you see there's new technology in the industry just going on that they have, like they did in the past, if somebody tells it to you, you have to try to show their evidence that they're going to do. What is the trigger for them to go through and have advanced technology from the different companies?
Well, there is a permit process in what it is. Once they're permitted, you can operate under that permit, and that sort of process comes. So that's how resource review operates, and if they change the thing off, they would then have to do it, and the process is put. If there's new technology that comes online tomorrow, you can't say, you've already invested this amount of money, go and spend additional money.
Well, that's what I was wondering, how that would happen. So, unless some new state legislation recognizes new technology if it's significant, and sort of go back and revisit the current.
So we found a source that we thought was really problematic in contributing to non-attendance standards, and we definitely were working with that. And we could develop rules through the CAP process to address that. But this is a little bit different because of the state came in and said, you need to look at these facilities. And some districts have a lot more than us, some don't have any, but they were designated by the state. So they realized that these facilities have been operating this way. There's not a lot of change in what they've been in the loss. They've been using those burners out there from the dawn of time.
Yeah.
There's been no pressure from them. Yeah.
Are there other questions? Other suggestions?
I just had a question in terms of the number of these units being fairly small, and I imagine that regulations, whether legislation was passed in a community where you probably have a lot of use of these things and industry that's generating often or not. And so my question is, how much of the total stationary source, not stored, is coming from these particular units? Are they a large part of the component in our air basin, or is this kind of a more legislatively mandated environment and not such a critical area of focus for us in terms of trying to address them?
So two answers. One, it's mandated, so we can't really make a decision on our own. Number two, there are technologies now that can drastically reduce the amount from 50 parts per million down to 15. So that's huge. So we would apply any industry that would want to go with that to that way to reduce emissions. So I don't have an annualized amount on the commercial, I think we're going to say 79. But that essentially inventory is not driving this. I mean, it should help considerably, but it depends on how often it's processed.
Yeah, how often
it's used. Yeah. So, it's like the challenge is really hard to know because the inventory is all based on actual throughput, what was the actual usage. These were all based upon my potential analysis. Like, that's why I did a assuming it's operating at 100%, 75%, 25%, 50%. So that's why there's a huge range. We don't know what exactly is, by retrofitting this rule, what would be the approximate or the actual reduction. So that's why I can only give you a big range of approximate.
I think those are good questions. What I would like to see as background information is the percentage of the NOx inventory attributable to the source category, and like to see daily emissions for the reductions and compare them to the overall inventory. I think it's important to relate all of this to why we're doing it, which is to meet the ozone standard, and that creates background information that could be informative to the board.
Yes, but I mean, that was like the purpose of the prepare initiative for the statement from now. And so it's a more detailed analysis. We're required and tasked with this. We can put that together as far as the budget and let you look at the numbers, but as far as the deciding factor, I mean, they have to look at the numbers.
It's not that complicated to figure out what source what emission, not emissions, are related to this inventory and convert the 550 tons per year to daily emissions. And just
no, but as you know, and you worked it with the tractor, it's not all feasible measures. We're looking at mass trailers and so forth, and in fact, very, there's a few pounds. I mean, the comparison is huge, but we can do that. We will do that. I mean, that's not a problem.
Yeah.
It should be a 15-minute analysis. Anyway, that would be my suggestion for the staff report this in background. Motions in order to recommend adoption of this to the board?
I'll second it.
there is nobody from the public? Oh, you're okay. Okay, it's been moved and seconded to recommend adoption, and we'll take public comments.
My name is Lance Erickson. I'm a health, environmental, and safety specialist with Chevron. I also worked for this air district for a number of years, so it's a little confusing when I come here.
You look familiar.
I'm speaking of the regulated industry today. Chevron is probably more impacted by this rule than any other industry company, I should say. There are a couple, I really like to thank Amy, Mary, and Ron for putting together a workable rule in a very short period of time. I have two comments, really, and two notes. Nothing that I would object to in the rule. The rule, I think, was well thought out and well done. Just as a comment, we were talking about the cost effectiveness. It's a little confusing. For the units, and we have to retrofit, it costs about $2 million to retrofit a unit, a steam generator, to meet these levels. It costs about $50,000 a year in additional operating costs to operate the equipment that meets these levels. Chevron has a commitment to be in compliance with all environmental regulations, and we're willing to spend the money we need to comply with this regulation. But it is a significant cost. When you consider a steam generator probably costs about $4 or $4.5 million, you're spending a lot to up to speed. The other thing that's fortunate for Chevron, however, is that due to a permitting action and about 10 years ago, a number of our units are already equipped, as Rich was describing, to meet this regulation. So we have six process heaters and 19 steam generators that are active that would be affected by this rule. So unfortunately, not all 19, not spent $2 million on all 19 units. There are two comments that I've already made to the district, so I don't think this is going to be a surprise. One is that an annual source test is required. An annual source test makes perfect sense, except there's better technology out there. And we had proposed during the development process, and it got lost in the shuffle somewhere, to do a less frequent source test, perhaps defer the stack test for a couple of years, but do monitoring with a portable analyzer. Something a little less complicated, but like you take your car in for a smog check, or you put something in the tailpipe, put something in the stack or the unit, determine what the emissions are at that time, and then take appropriate action. I think we recommended doing that once every quarter, so you get a reading of where you're at on your emissions 4 times a year rather than 1 time a year. And the reason we're recommending that is it costs about a little less than $2,000 to go out and do the portable monitoring on all our steam generators each time you do that. And it costs between $2,500 and $5,000 to do each steam generator's stack test. So the stack tests don't give you any better data, really. So we feel this is a win-win. And the staff, I'll be meeting with the staff later. So I'd like the committee to really consider endorsing that. Type of change of flexibility. I think you still have the option of a standalone source test. The other exemption we talked about with the district is standby units. A number of our units don't run very often, but they run when another unit, in our case, we have cogens that produce a lot of steam. From time to time, those cogens, which produce both electricity and steam, need to be shut down for an extended maintenance period. And for or may have a breakdown where you have to wait for parts to replace the equipment. We'd like to ask for consideration not to retrofit units if they run essentially less than 20% of the time in a year, and replace the unit, replace the only operator when another unit is down. And that would actually, I believe, I don't have the math in front of me, but would result in a lower emission for the standby units operating and find no air quality issues associated with the standby unit. Again, we'll be talking with the district later on that issue. Couple of quick notes. The loss of the exemption, I haven't brought this one up. It basically says you have to retrofit within 1 year. And while I don't object to that in concept, Chevron's a big company and moves kind of slowly. So It takes almost a year of planning and then a period of time to do the retrofit. So I would like to consider that going from up to a little longer, 18 months to 2 year period. And the last comment is that I don't know if the slide's still up there. We're talking about 90,000 therms, and at least for oil companies, we don't think in therms. We think in MMBTUs. Everything in my head runs in those units. And I think it's a conversion, it's a 10-fold conversion. But I just ask that they be expressed both ways so I can get my head around a little better. Those are all my, those are the issues I wanted to bring forth.
So, if I get a chance, is there a possibility, I've seen some cost estimates between retrofit versus replacement. Is Chevron also looking at wholesale replacement?
Well, we have, I mentioned we have 19 active units. We also have 9 inactive units, and they would require, in addition to this rule retrofit, they would require capital to put the unit back and get operating condition. And on those units, we would probably replace. And at that point, we'd have to deal with new sources. We might end up with a lower unit. Yes?
In terms of volatility of the usage gas, is that based on the market? On the amount of product you're trying to produce at that particular time based on the market?
It's not flexible. Let's put it this way, that way. There is a, if you made, let's pick a number, 10,000 barrels, just use that as a number, of oil today because the price was $60 a barrel. And the price doubled to $120 a barrel. Tomorrow we wouldn't be producing 11,000 barrels or 20,000 barrels. There's just not that much flexibility in what you can produce. If the market drops to a significant amount, like $20 a barrel, happened in the last 10 years, we would cut back on our streams, we cut back on our operations. But generally try to run a steady state and make the amount of oil we can make, maximum amount we can make, depending on the market. And generally the market allows us to sell everything we make. I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, I just was trying to get an idea of how much you're affected by the market.
So to summarize,
obviously the machinery is going to.
Yeah, there's kind of a competition between oil fields. We have this much, we can make this much for oil, someone else can make more. In general, I think it's fairly profitable. As long as we can continue to operate.
I want to summarize what you have requested and ask that to respond.
Thank you.
You are requesting annual source test every 2 years?
Every 5 years is my proposal.
Every 5 years, and in between, you would have quarterly portable monitoring.
Yes.
Your second request is to exempt standby units that are used less than 20% per year, and only for those units when the equipment is down. Is that right?
Thank you. That's exactly correct.
And the other point is to extend the phase-in period to 2 years.
If one of those exempt units lost the exemption, it just takes longer to monitorize.
And then the last one is to change therms to BTUs?
Use both, put in both sets.
So would staff respond to those four requests? So we will not have the benefit of that. Well, I don't know if the committee wants to entertain the suggested changes or recommend that we forward this to the board with a staff analysis of the changes.
If I may add one more comment, this is not a new concept for the terrain source test. It's included in the other area I work in the San Joaquin Valley Air District. They have a deferment there for 3 years. I recommended 5 because that's consistent with the Title V permit.
So this is part of the process of negotiation and working out. I think what you've heard from Lance and Chevron with these comments, I don't think they would necessarily say no to this rule in total. We're willing to look at what he suggested and what Chevron's suggesting, and that's how we usually conduct these things. And so I don't think it's going to, the quarterly testing versus, you know, yearly versus every 5 years is not going to play into the actual reduction that we've seen. So I think leave us to negotiate with folks on that end, and in concept, what you have here is what's proposed, and it may change. There may be minor changes to it, but nothing substantial that would change the outcome of the rule.
And I refer to this working with the staff to do that. I don't think there's a necessary action by the advisory committee.
Motion's in order.
However, we'll continue to comment on it.
We'll make a motion to approve the staff recommendation.
We actually have a motion and second. Thank you, Ron.
So, back to the committee discussion of the motion to support staff recommendation.
I'm good with it because I assume with tens of billions of dollars at stake that these oil companies will show up and negotiate and continue to negotiate with the board. So I'm okay.
Okay.
I don't feel like I can make a substantive decision about this issue. I don't have the technical information to answer. So the staff will represent the district, and I think Chevron will do a good job representing the area.
Any other comments? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say no.
No.
One no. Motion carried. Okay, thank you very much. Okay. Go call.
Nay.
Yes. Yes.
Okay, thank you. The next item is to receive a presentation on air quality tracks and an environmental education program from the middle and high school classroom.
Thank you. A little lighter subject this time. Hi, good afternoon. I'm here to talk about a new environmental education program that we're going to try out for middle and high school classrooms. It's called AQ TREX. AQ TREX is designed around a personal air monitoring device. Like this is a handheld device. It measures several pollutants and has GPS integrated into the system. It can transmit the data that's collected through via Bluetooth directly into a smartphone that has the AQ TREX application downloaded onto it. So students can take the unit on a little hike around the community. And as they're walking along, the unit will collect data
It'll take a measurement every 30 seconds or so, and it'll transmit that data directly to the student's cell phone. So you can see these students here are walking around with their cell phones and seeing the data that is collected immediately on their phones. They can then take the air monitoring device back to their classroom, upload it on their computer to the that's actually AQTREC's website, and they can view their trek and the data that goes along with it, and see where there are higher or lower concentrations of the different pollutants that they've collected. They can also get a graphical interface of the data, or graphical output of the data as well, which you'll see on the right-hand graphic. You want to click on the... So this is a trek that was done in Bakersfield. If you zoom in on the over Bakersfield and just zoom in on it. Scroll. Do you have a scroll button? Do you have a scroll zoom? Yeah, a little more. If you just click on any one of those symbols, and then you can see at what time and what location and what concentration of that pollutant is taken. You can see there it's CO2, 415 parts per million, and that was taken at 5:25 p.m. I think. Anyhow. The straight line is the green line. That's another trek that was taken. Someone must have gotten in the car and driven around and took a sample. Mm-hmm. Oh, there you go. Thanks, Andy. All right.
If they're breathing hard and have a
right, yeah. So the advantage of this program is that it's we get the air monitoring device. It's rental unit. It's $360 for 3 weeks. We don't have to buy anything, so and it's scalable. So we can, if there's more classrooms that want the equipment, then we can rent more. It also is low maintenance. We don't have to do any of the maintenance. We don't have to do any of the calibrations. So there's no real expensive upfront costs, and you can just try out the program. There's a curriculum that's already developed so that the teachers can adopt the parts of the curriculum that fit what they want to teach. And we provide outreach to get the program out to the community to see which school districts want to participate. We provide the equipment rental and training on how to use the equipment. So far, we've had the Hartnell College Environmental Science class has tried it. We have interest from the Steinbeck Center for their summer school program as well. So with that, I'll be happy to answer any of your questions. And if you'd like, after the meeting today, Bill, our supervisor, our air monitoring supervisor, he will take you on a trek if you'd like to stay around.
So we get the kids moving around. Yeah. We get to educate them on the way. And we get free data?
Yeah.
I mean, ish.
Free-ish. Not a huge investment.
Data, or does this monitor?
PM2.5, PM10, CO, CO2, relative humidity, temperature. Is there any other?
So we're talking about PM10 and CO?
PM2.5, CO2.
So does the curriculum really tell the students what, give meaning to these data?
Yes, that's the intention, to help interpret it, to help interpret the data. And it just depends on the instructor if they want to use the program to help teach their courses.
So it's both pollutants and sort of atmosphere.
Yes.
So that's $360 per unit?
For 3 weeks.
So all these students walk around with one piece of equipment?
Yeah, that's right. And if they have a cell phone, they can download the app, and the unit transmits the data that's collected directly to their phones.
So in your opinion, what information is being gained by the students about air pollution through this process?
It's an environmental awareness program, really. It's to help teach kids about how the effects of certain different areas that we might collect data might have higher concentrations of certain pollutants than others. So just what's affecting their community. So if they go by a roadway and they're seeing higher concentrations of PM10, or an intersection that has higher concentrations of PM10 or PM2.5, that would be, they could see the immediate impact of what they're affected by. Whether if they don't have this unit, they wouldn't see that necessarily. They might just be walking by that intersection every day and not see that there might be higher concentrations of PM2.5 or PM10.
So these are really hot spots in terms of informing.
Yeah, even a minor shift in a change that they might see would be instructive, I think.
And you said 3 weeks, right? So is this more like a subject or a course kind of thing where you give it to me for 3 weeks, and then after that 3 weeks, they just run it?
That's right, yes.
And then perhaps next semester, you give it to me for another 3 weeks, or you take it to another school for another 3 weeks, so it's not like it's going to be on loan for the equipment for the duration of the year, but they're using it for 3 weeks.
That's right, yeah. And the teacher, it's really up to the instructor, and they have to be not only willing, but wanting to bring this into their classroom and adapt it to what they're trying to teach, to whatever the program they're trying to teach. The environmental science instructor that we have loaned it to at Hartnell College has an air quality segment of his class that he teaches every year, and he's been visiting us. He brings his class out to our Salinas air monitoring station every semester, and it includes that as part of his program. And so he's actually adapted this unit as well, and he's trying to work it into his curriculum.
Is there upkeep on these things? So, for example, is that 360 just what it costs, and then it's basically replacing batteries after that?
Well, the Tubi Technology sends us the unit, and it's calibrated, and it's maintained. So we don't have to do anything. We take that, and we give it to the instructor. The instructor uses it in their classroom. And then at the end of that 3 weeks, they package it up and send it back to the company.
Oh, so we don't actually own it.
We don't own it. Yeah.
Just my observation when we did various education programs in the past, and one thing that students related to is air monitoring equipment. It's not really heavy duty policy stuff, but that's the kind of information that they do understand and have to use. How much is allocated towards this program in terms of the budget?
That's a good question. I don't have that number offhand. I think we set aside about roughly about $5,000 for that.
The district does have a pretty substantial $20% of that. But I can say from experience, having done this with adults, the first thing they do is they rely on towards a school bus or a bus or something to smoke in. And it's a race to the bottom, like people are trying to get the highest level. And but what's really interesting, you come back and you say, this is always the best way to buy, so look, it's higher than the standard for the bus. And so it's a relative deal, but it's really instrumental. And we talked to them through about sources and operations. So it's very informative and gets people involved. And this is the new rate for everyone, this personal monitor. Someday everyone's going to have one, and they're going to be funded with cell phones. So we're trying to get the public ready for this.
Seems like that presentation by the many speakers would be really wonderful at the end of the work.
Oh.
So, you know, and maybe there was really students which is suggested and wasn't very proud of it.
We guys can get a chance to do this if you'd like to spend some time with
them. Okay.
I don't know if there's any questions about that.
Any comments from the public? Okay.
My experience with field testing equipment over 30 plus years is it's got to be calibrated before you use it, calibrated afterwards to make sure it didn't slip. And that's with professionals using it. We're going to turn this stuff loose with a bunch of kids. How well has anybody looked to see if that equipment survives with its calibration intact?
Yeah, that's a good
that
question. That's
with numbers which mm-hmm. may lead them off on, oh, that's okay when it's not, or vice versa, or.
Yeah.
So I'd say sensor technology is one that's there are some that are pretty consistent with now. I think this is for the general purpose of teaching, even if it's not, we're not using this to teach it. So it's sort of a lot of things about how to do that. If we saw that the machine was not performing correctly, it was tagging in here and vaping.
Any other comments? If not, thank you very much. One thing to report from Rick.
So there's been a lot going on with staff, but unfortunately we're finding that not a whole lot going on at the board meeting. So you'll see, since we last met, I've got the 3 dates that the board met, September 18th, October 18th, and November 20th. The first of September, we adopted a resolution which basically allocated our fiscal year 20, 80, 77, 66 programs right in the bottom space. I do a lot of preparation when I put this report together. We also received a very similar presentation from David on FYI Trust and a number of the board members who are unable to get to the bonus and the actual graphic of copy. And you can see that the level time. On October 18th, we received a presentation on the California Federal Clean Air Act, and this may be something which you guys are interested in. The Trump administration currently is basically two things have happened. Number one, they removed the California waiver from the Clean Air Act. The California don't have its own program to regulate emissions from automobiles. It's pretty amazing. It's unprecedented. There's not even a method in the act to opt for this, but that has gone forward. And then the other part of that is bifurcated, and this part of the rules that the office manager and budget that is the new standards, the relaxed emission standards for all vehicles throughout the country out to California. And then we got a sanction, a threat of sanction for Administrator Wheeler of the EPA saying that California is going to be sanctioned because we're not meeting clean air standards. And it doesn't make sense to me as their colleagues that they could take away the primary tool we have to regulate coal sources, which are a definable problem in California, not to be anywhere else in the country. And then tell us we're not meeting a cleaner source. We were relying on that standard to meet all the attainments spread is throughout the state, because most of the pollution is from motor vehicles. So what this is going to do is going to shift the accountability and pollution reductions to stationary sources, which they've already given their blood from the turnip. And you can see they're getting some reductions, which probably aren't going to amount to a whole lot. But it's going to make it more difficult for stationary sources in California to meet the federal and state limits.
Rich, I understand some automobile companies signed an agreement with California that will keep the stringent standard in place.
So if I remember correctly, it was Ford, Honda, VW, and anyways, not Toyota.
General Motors here, and then there's the Rescindible.
So there's four of them, and I'm just missing one of the big ones. Anyways, so they agreed to follow California standards. California's going to continue. The Trump administration immediately got the Department of Justice to look at the Trump violations. But this was, they said, quid pro quo, and that's something we've been hearing a lot about. So if it went along with California would sanction a lot of things. The problem is that they undertook this voluntarily. And these manufacturers are competing on a global stage. And it makes sense that we would want to get, because other states and other countries are dealing with emissions as well, and they're trying to get cleaner vehicles. So yes, it makes no sense to me and to the federal officials to act on
plus. It creates all this uncertainty. You're going to have a change in administration sooner or later, and they'll go back to the old standards. So this creates so much uncertainty in the automobile industry.
And yeah, in California, not only is it the emission standards that are important, but the adoption of electric vehicles. Without electric vehicles, we can't make it to the next level. I don't care what you do, we could drop the standards. Once again, it has to be feasible on motor vehicles, but the only way we're going to get to where we need to go is because we have a considerable number of electric vehicles in the state. And we're well on the way there. And California experience, I think it's a stage right issue. And the administration has been talking about cooperative federalism, which says let states do what they want. Let them figure out how to regulate. And they came in and said, after 50 years of California leading the way on emissions reduction technologies for motor vehicles, they said we can no longer do it. So California's suing. I think California has about 30 lawsuits against the Trump administration, most of them in the environmental and some in social stuff. But it's just becoming sort of like a deadlock with the company. Anyway, so I gave a presentation on what that means and what California is actually accomplished. For example, in the South Coast, with a quadrupling in population, we have reduced, and with more than tripling of vehicle miles traveled, maybe even more than that, quadrupling of vehicle miles traveled as well, thereabouts. We have reduced air pollution from 75 to 90% in the vehicles. And that's because of the new technologies that have been passed by California. And by the way, it's for 177 states. There's 13 other states in the United States that have adopted California's emission standards, so it's not just like they're running alone. And the red states, though, interestingly enough, are really pissed off because they see this as a violation of states' rights. They do not want the feds telling them what they can and cannot do. So it's a problem, and as Janet said, the next administration is probably going to do everything that Trump has done to reverse all the Obama laws.
Because all those laws have been the states. The federal government should be making any laws about cars. So it'll be up to the state. Well, there's nothing in the Constitution that says anything about cars.
So it gets a little complicated, but I will say there is something called interstate commerce. So if you're selling cars among the states, so the only logical thing that the Trump administration can say is they want to make one vehicle for the United States and one emission standard. Right? They don't want to have California and those 13 other states they just want to say everybody has. So what they did is they dumbed it down, which in my book is not going the right direction. And it's also, they call it the SAFE rule. And what they're saying is that with these new emission standards, and I'm sorry to go on for a long time, but with these new emission standards, cars are not going to be lighter. They're going to be heavier, because the only way to really get to some of these is by innovative carbon fiber and other advanced kinds of composites to lighten the vehicles. And they say that those cars are more unsafe than heavier vehicles, which makes absolutely no sense, because they have to meet the National Transportation Safety Highway Administration's crash test. So we have a lot of engineering that goes into cars now, and they are light in most cars, but by that same argument, that everybody should drive a Tesla because they're one of the heaviest vehicles in the world with their batteries. So it just doesn't make sense, but, you know, I could go on, but this is sort of like we just slipped through the rabbit hole, and so we'll let the attorneys figure it out. There's some folks who say that there's folks that after this, but it's already done with respect to the waiver, and then courts are saying that. So it's sort of crazy, but like I said, it's really unfair to stationary sources throughout the area. Unless the feds are going to come and tell us how to do that too. That may happen. So without further ado, let me just go. We also had a resolution adopting our call on Moyer program policies and procedures update last time. And then Amy did a really great presentation. If you want me to get into this, the power safety shutoffs, public health, power shutoffs, it's crazy. There's no indication that those actually do any good. Yet we're doing them, and we're going to see a lot more people trying to get backup generators, and they're not available, the compliant ones, and it's not our loss, the state's loss. So the state is actually being sort of flexible on this, and we're, I promise to the board that we will not, we can, we'll be as flexible as possible. But I'm just afraid that every restaurant that has perfect products is going to go out and buy a haunted diesel generator. And
well, I mean, you know what happens in Solidad? They shut the power down for a day and a half. And Food Code lost like $250,000 in food.
Right.
And there wasn't that windy down there. I was there.
Well, there's a good joke. I'll tell you.
Well, there's a very ominous side of it, which is if you're on a well and you have and you don't have gravity, you don't have fire protection.
It's also for public, also on treatment works and for water systems. If they don't have access, you don't get water.
Yeah,
you don't get sewer.
Yeah. So you can go to a store someplace and get a bottle of water, but you can't hook up a hose to something that isn't there.
Well,
and that becomes a real big problem.
Yeah, we're going to see, and this is already, there's a mad rush on everybody by generators, which ironically, some of these gas fired ones are actually fire hazards.
Yeah.
So anyway, stay tuned on this. They are saying that this problem won't be solved for another 10 years.
No, we're going to
get solved.
What
does
the CPUC then do about PG&E?
Well, there's discussions that they're going to deregulate and find out. But to say with the rain now, it's probably not an issue that we have to worry about that again just recently.
And in the meantime, how many thousands of generators are
well, let's just look at Napa, Sonoma, and Mendocino County, who are very affected by these and will be for the foreseeable future. That time of year is crushed for the wine business. So that's somewhere north of 1,200 wineries. Guarantee you there's going to be 1,200 diesel generators at some point if this keeps going on. It's a big part of the business. So, I mean, I already know because we couldn't make the living.
Yeah,
but yet the guys who had, and guess what? The guys that had diesel generators weren't in compliance with their energy. They just went and did because they didn't have a choice.
So that's going to be an issue. We're going to take those things into consideration just because they're is not the inventory right now. People can rent these things, and some of these are supposed to be what's called the portable equipment registration program, PERC. They should be PERC by the state or district. But We're hoping that people get generators that, we're going the wrong way, in other words. We're turning into a third world country. So,
well, an unreliable grid is how you get there.
Yeah. So that, it's become a problem, and we anticipate it will be more of a problem for us. We're already seeing this without the SPS on the growers of cannabis. Because right. They're going out, they can't get the electricity, so they're going out and they're buying whatever they can find. Then they come to us for somebody to change from us, and it turns out to be not a plan. And then we tell them, well, you bought that because somebody was trying to unload it on you.
Right.
And you should have talked to us first.
So somebody that goes and rents from Quinn to Caterpillar is probably getting the tier one,
prompt.
Tier zero,
no.
If they're renting them.
No, no. If they're renting them, they should be getting a compliant. But the rental ones, it's tier two or tier three.
I always go the wrong way.
Yeah. Yeah.
Tier three or tier four, yeah. Most likely.
Most likely. Need. Although we have one guy, and we're looking at doing an enforcement action, who's been actually purposefully putting not compliant engines in people's hands. So, you know, people are trying to make a buck off this. That always happens. But what I assured the board and what the board told me is that we would proceed with caution on this and not just kind of looking at it. That's not something I want to do. We understand that it's a public health issue, and we don't have one of the tools and one of the tools. If we have somebody that situates a huge 1,000 horsepower piece of generator right next to a rest home or a nursery or something like that, and this year, then we're going to have the conference. So, for the most part, we're going to try to deal with it as it happens.
Well, the other issue is residential, too, because you know, I had a cousin, up in Sonoma, and they were from my direction on fire, but they got set off, and he had a choice. He had a backup generator, one of those small, typical residential pellets, but he had a choice to hook his well up to it or his house, and, you know. So he's now thinking about getting a much bigger backup that he can run his whole household on. You know, so that's going to, you know, it may not be as big as the industrial ones eventually, but that's going to add more and more soon.
Yeah. So anyway, it's unfortunate. We do not regulate anything on the digital side. So, we get a lot of complaints about these things, and we say, diesel really consumes cannabis that is a gas of 500. So I'll just go through this really quickly on engineering. We've adopted a new record protection schedule. I don't have that currently, but basically it's 5 years or 3 or 4. So we're going to be throwing away a lot more paper. That protects the district. It also, statute of limitations typically 3 years, which is a problem that should be going for that. We spend a lot of time doing that so we can get our not only paper records but our electronic management system. We also, speaking of wastewater treatment facilities, these guys turned out that they're a high hazard for toxic and that's due to their extensive generators. And so we had a number of things that showed up in 25. As a matter of fact, talked about the requirements for these, and that was before the PSPS, so I'm sure there's not more questions for us. We also had an environmental compliance workshop and Dr. Allen, remember responded.
One of my favorite people was Dawn.
Yes, so Dawn was great. She came from the county and she was just working up here and we really happy to have her here. But we let just sort of know them as asbestos with hazardous waste and being in our environment. We've been having problems with a lot of cities. They're dropping our checklist off their permit requirements. So we don't know that they should check with us, and that's their streamlining. That's a lot of cities are streamlining by telling them they don't have to check with us. So we're going through a lot of enforcement cases right now, and we're very much for the district. We've had a lot of meetings here for the California Fugitive Officers Association in October. We had a meeting here in town. We also had a compliance meeting up in Sacramento with staff presenter. And then we had the group recovery in our office. We also, during board approved the variance some class one preparation for the EC sector, after a natural gas fiber that was in generators. For a short period of time, when they shut off their current grid to install solar panels at their substation. PG&E, as I said, this has just been a nightmare for us, but since the spending now, so we're not looking at the fire. Although I keep on saying this, the Thomas Fire in LA has to be the same as PG&E, but it should be right about that. David's here, so he can tell me how many vehicles we've processed thus far. So I think we're right around, we're close to 200 vehicles, and we've spent about half the money, $40,000, and we've used to incentivize the purchase or lease of electric vehicles.
You had this for the last year, please?
Yes, we've had it for about 4 years.
Is it trending up?
We're trying to find the sweet spot where people will use the incentive. And so it's actually very popular, and we teamed up with the Modern Day Community Power for the first half of the program, and they weren't as successful as a new program for them. But we hope to keep this. I propose to the board that we just turn it over to Community Power, because having two programs that are competing is confusing. But the board, this, and I didn't know this, I got to this panel, this is your town jewel. So a number of board members have taken advantage of this program too, so I'm glad to hear it. It was unfortunate that I found out about it that way. You don't want to propose something the board can't do in a school bus.
Anyway, how many school buses do we have now that are arrested?
I think we've had about 10.
Except from one, the last time I heard.
So we've been also working with Monterey Bay Community Power. We're going to actually find out some money for us so we can start supplying some of those. This is one of those stories where I try not to talk too loudly about it because we've spent about $7 million or $8 million over the past decade getting schools to change out dirty diesels to cleaner diesel buses. And now we're telling them to get rid of those buses and put in electric. So I don't know what the next wave fusion bus is probably going to be. We also have Farmer, which we've been part of a large grant package that the state for giving, including the AB6607 to the agriculture program. Farmer, I can't tell you what it is, but it's a lot of part of the emission reduction that it's got farms, agriculture. And so we've been replacing tractors and irrigation pumps with clean water engines. And we're sort of dovetailed that into our Carl Moyer program, so we've got a healthy list of subjects to find. We also opened our DC fast charging station in Camp Roberts West Station, and that was in collaboration with the Caltrans, and they're one of the first DC fast charging stalls in California, and that's where they're at. And they can do their self-contained unit, they use solar power, and they can do 4 to 6 cars per day. You tell people, just get enough fuel to get to where you need to go to charge them. So it's a nice oasis in that 101 corridor between Paso and here.
So,
yeah.
And they consider 4 to 6 cars a day fast?
It is, considering that these things are standalone, they're not wired into the grid. Like the cannabis guys, there is no power there, or limited power. We actually did trench in some trickle chargers for the batteries. That number should go up to maybe more. But, you know, that's 4 full chargers, the 4 to 6 full chargers. So you'd have to be sitting there with people lining up and just saying, no, I'm going to get a full charge here. It is free.
Oh, okay, I
but
see.
But we tell people.
Because I'm going, that doesn't sound bad.
But they are.
I got an electric car, but I have to sit when I fuel up for 7 hours.
It is fast considering it's just directly from solar on a battery. We use, like the one at Springdale, is a lot faster. That uses grid and a battery. So we can get the
application.
Well,
yeah. Well,
it's well placed because there's not any.
Let me tell you, it was a big deal getting Caltrans to agree. We do not like to see any kind of vendor decide to move with a machine at the school. We don't have many more training and workouts. So, I guess Pastor Elvis is going to get a few of these in a lot of time. So we were the pioneers here. This is the first in the nation that I know of. It's standard on the school card charging station. So it's good stuff. I'm sure it'll be a first for me to get back, but at least we're getting it going. And then San Lorenzo Valley, I don't know if you have anything here from San Lorenzo Valley, but that's always a problem every year because of wood smoke Flow monitors, there's been season out there for a lot, but levels of smell are different from five. There's a list of where we deployed them. We also have a wintertime spare the air program, which is voluntary, but we hope that people think it's mandatory because they have a mandatory vote in the area. We're not sure we have the staff that could enforce an mandatory program, but we do get the word out if the air quality is impaired. We have something like inversions or something like that. We'll let people know that we have a forecast in case that will be a happy investment for companies that are not enduring to make it through. So that's a pretty and then we just had a student art contest. We worked up there with Pierce McPherson's office out of the county. It's sponsored by the Office of Water Women's Department. We award students from their efforts on art. And yes, we're purposely trying to get students involved in what we're doing this year. We'll probably put on our website for women's pictures and this website. I think we give them $100 for their efforts that they're doing. So it's a really nice thing that we can be up there and get some of that about. There's a lot of other stuff going on here, but at this time, I'll stop and ask.
I just have a comment about Monterey Beach. It would be a good idea if they advertise more for successes. The public is abysmally ignorant about this. I follow all this stuff on Next Door Neighbors, and you know, it's just over the top in terms of their lack of knowledge, and they have all sorts of conspiracy theories going on about power.
Or just trying to understand the literature they do put out,
right,
in terms of how everything fits together,
right,
in the whole system.
I'm on their advisory committee, and I got to tell you, I think stuff I don't understand. It's like there's this PCIA propaganda that's been implemented by PG&E that compensates them for their loss of trust in this. And that seems to be a 10% tax. Monterey Bay Community Power says they'll discount 3% or less, which when are they discounting and what's the total amount? And then people don't understand if their bills have gone up, it's primarily due to heat, while the gas prices, the natural gas has gone up. And PG&E has natural gas as well, even if you're getting it. And so people get all like, my bill went up, but we need to do a little more detailed analysis. I could take that back to them. They've had a lot of successes, and these guys are reaching in dollars.
Well,
that's what I was going to say. I'm going to say at some point they're going to have enough money to do any kind of advertising that they want.
They're hiring the crazy. They are.
I mean, remember 5 years ago PG&E didn't advertise at all. And now it's on television all the time.
That's more PR.
Well, that's exactly what it is because it's how you spend your money.
PG&E advertises all the time about the latest rate increase they want. And they advertise that.
Well, they advertise about, I'm going to check the trees and save them.
So we're on the future agenda items. Do you have a presentation on the PG&E shutoff thing?
I think that would be really helpful.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, and I have no comments.
Just a general comment on future agenda items. We're charged with looking at this. The issues that are brought before us, and making recommendations and recommending the approval of the board. But when we get, and I put the caveat that I understand the staff gets challenged with short time frames and that sort of thing, but it really would behoove everyone on staff that the earliest possible time is not before all the decisions have been made. I mean, where we get the full package the way it's going to be presented to the board for what we're recommending, we have knowledge at this meeting that that is what is going to be presented to the board. Where in the case of today, we trust staff and we're voting 5 or
that it would be nice to not put the cart before the horse.
Well, I should just touch back on that a little bit. Sorry, I'm still thinking about this, but those negotiations happen all the time, and the board actually, if Chevron comes and talks to the board, but the board usually says, we approve this in concept to work out the details, they don't need to get any, you know, are you going to argue four parts per million, or five, or six? And I would just say this, I need to know if you guys are getting this, if the staff reports are not sufficient enough to get this done, then, we are into the gun with the 617 section. You know, we could always delay for some of that additional information, so please let me know if the paper is there, or it seems totally convoluted, you don't understand it, or what's going on. You know, Sylvia, I heard some stuff earlier, that was going on, and what you understand what this is about, so that's all I'm asking you guys about, so if you still want to tell us about it before the meeting.
Well, that's one issue of
responsibility.
The other issue that I'm really addressing is that to get a package before negotiations have been completed with the stakeholders this time, it's kind of hard for us to say, we agree with that, but we don't know what we're really agreeing to because we don't know what the final report is. I mean, in general, I mean, there's last-minute details sometimes that jump up, but for the most part, I think to give us a complete package to the best of your ability, that would be
and that's
ideal.
And I think I want to just once again say that what you heard from Chevron is not that they have a problem with this board, a problem spending the money. They are good with it. There's a few particulars that they would, of course, want to work out with it. But I don't see those as really foundational to the board itself. So if you're expecting that to be all worked out, you know, we sometimes implementations are a lot different than what the rules say. It's required for us to adopt these questions, and that's what we've done. We try to work this stuff out. We've done a number of things that we've done. We sort of plant speech up very loudly to these rules. So, but I would just say, do not do it. And they are pretty much doing this work. And that's the job of the so I don't know what sort of what point you're going to see it, but you know, if you want to see the analysis, I'm happy to get that done.
I guess it comes down to a bigger issue of you know, the purpose of this committee, you know, what our work is, and whether we're doing anything worthwhile. And if we're really just rubber stamping things, without really having...
Well, the problem is in the public hearing process, you can always have comments throughout the whole process, and there's never a final staff position. And so what we did today was support the staff recommendation. And, you know, another approach is to support something in concept and you go figure out the details. But Jeff, you wanted to
Yeah, in my situation, Jen asked me those questions. We didn't have the information for it, because I was after the motion to be accepted. So because of the motion was presented, I didn't take that position for it. Had we had more information, we could have tabled it. We could have voted it down. We brought it back up to table the item so we can get the information. But as my vote was based on just what I heard before. I wanted to hear more about it because basically, like you said, there's a juice with the seed, the amount of dollars pumped in that you guys have to put out for what you call low hanging fruit.
So, and I tried to explain earlier, it doesn't really matter. We're required to do it. So you could sit there and say it's going to help us. It's going to hinder us. It's going to help. But it's going to help a lot compared to some of the other measures that we had on the past. So, I guess that at that point, I thought it was pretty nice, especially about why deviation is good and safety for whatever it was for the time of the year and what we're going to
do. Well, by bringing this up, I wasn't trying to reopen,
no, but I don't want
reopen to, what we did here today. I'm just saying, for future, I think that it would
And I also fully understand that you can't get it fully narrowed down to, you know, exactly what could happen in the flood range that makes a decision. But all I'm saying is you've got the court presented to us to nail as much stuff down as possible.
Jeff, just because something has been moved and seconded, that does not preclude discussion.
Correct.
Okay.
But there was a motion on the floor.
But you could have moved, if you, what you're saying is, you could have moved to table, and then, and then we could have discussed that, and that's what I think you're saying.
Well, and you could have discussed the motion. I thought you said that.
$10 million to reduce SMR.
I thought you felt as though you couldn't discuss the motion after it had been moved and seconded.
I mean, based on conversation, I knew it was going to happen anyway.
I just want to clarify from a parliamentary procedure perspective. You could have
discussed.
And I'll just say this, I don't want you guys to be a rubber stamp either. If you don't understand it, then take it back to the trade equipment class.
When the conversation is left, place goes up. That's all we have. Been here long enough, janitor, that time. If there's something going on, there'll be butts in the seats, and we'll know that we're talking about something important.
And I
not
think...
Not to diminish, but we are just the advisory committee. The board is going to decide.
And
but on the other hand, we have to fill out the conflict of interest forms.
And it's going to happen regardless. I mean, it doesn't really matter what we voted here today. It's going to happen.
So if I went to the board and said, we propose this to the advisory committee, and they not put a shot at that or comment, I guarantee the board would say, okay, you're not done. You need to take it back to that and get something that's going to improve. So that's why I say it's not a rubber stamp. I mean, I appreciate you approving that my report to say you guys approved this monitoring system. I just don't know if it's a but, you know, for various reasons, and hopefully that in terms of patients and folks that you've started. So, I, you know, like I said, if it's sort of under the gun, you know, sometimes these things are really complicated. You know, if you could just tell me that, if you get the package to say, I'm not sure I'm tracking on this, then let me know that we can try to
And I wasn't trying to reopen the agenda. I was talking about future agenda. Future agenda.
But that really, I just think,
general comment.
I think that kind of what Scott said. Our role here is to kind of gatekeep, and so that when there is a regulation that's very difficult, creates a lot of controversy, we can help negotiate that process with stakeholders, and staff, to work out some resolution before it goes to the board. And I really don't feel like I'm here, I don't have the technical expertise to determine whether it should be fully, you know, and
you're not supposed to.
But I'm just saying, so the issue today to me didn't seem to be material because I don't feel like that's our role. Our role is to look at if the standards heading to affect the goals that are required under the rule.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You guys are, some boards should say, like, a hearing board, you have to be other kind of person, like a doctor, a lawyer, an engineer, so if you have all these, they're required under statute. Here, so you guys are representing the public. So, you know, some of you have industry experience, college experience, and so you can give us feedback. I see this as sort of the first stop. If we had this thing passed and we probably say we need to go out and have something to come to the office. But, you know, this fiscal program 617, okay, the mic's off. It's a total sham. California, in my opinion, gets going to the large districts. Large districts are getting over $250 million in the program. We only have four facilities. Some of these large districts have thousands of facilities. And so they have a lot of work to do. And we don't have that much. So, you know, we're getting money to do it in the state, which is not there's a lot of districts, believe it or not, that are having a good amount of problems. It's just the number of districts and so it takes so much time to do it and difficult. So, this is something that I could get at this moment. It's coming from the application that we're struggling with. So it makes a lot of sense. I've voiced my concern to the resources board about this, but they're closer to the And believe me, cost effective, we could do a presentation on cost effective as well.
Well, I thought Alan and Scott's comments about resistance per ton or per unit was very insightful question.
Well, I was trying to do the math quick.
Yeah, and clarification.
$10 million, somebody's going to be paying attention.
Okay, maybe it's adjourned. Thank you. It's all of those.
Good rehearsal for the board. I mean, it works. If we're going to see, we're all, I'm going to have a hard time.
I didn't laugh back.